39, Sunday's high 45. Right now it's 30. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. And in this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be returning to a topic that we first explored a couple of weeks ago, namely the current theatrical production being performed at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, a play by Lauren Gunderson titled Silent Sky. And this is the story of three female astronomers from around the turn of the last century, at the dawn of the 20th century, and chief among them, Henrietta Swan Leavitt. She and two other women were astronomers at the Harvard College Observatory. And Henrietta Swan Leavitt actually managed to make some very, very significant discoveries. And so this is the story of what it was like to be a woman working in the field of astronomy at a time when that was relatively uncommon. So with us is Jennifer Sassaman, who is director of the production, and two of the students who are in the cast, Bailey Johnston, who performs the crucial role of Henrietta Swan Leavitt herself, and Josh Pride, who performs the role of Peter. He is the chief love interest in the play, and he is also in the play an astronomer at the Harvard College Observatory. We welcome all three of you back to the morning show.
Thanks so much.
So it's good for us to highlight this, and we should say that we are recording this interview well before the play is opened even the first time. But Jennifer, let me ask you, in anticipation of a big break between the first weekend of performances and the second week of performances, what is that like for you as a director and for your cast members? I mean, is that a challenge that is common? I should think not.
I think taking a week off of a show is not super common. That's not something that we've done at Parkside since I started teaching there. I think that when shows are in rep, sometimes it can be a little while. I think you can often go dark for 4 or 5 days at a time, and I think at that point it's pretty common to do what we call a brush-up rehearsal, where we just kind of walk through and try and remember where all the marks are and what all the lines are and what the staging is. If you're doing a musical, then you have to run all the choreography. This show has so many technical elements, and in fact, we have a much bigger crew that runs the scene changes than we do an actual cast on stage.
Wow.
So it's almost like a ballet to watch this team of people sweep in and change everything and leave very quickly. So when we do the brush-up rehearsal, this isn't common, but we will also need to rehearse the ballet of the scene changes as well. So we will do that. We take Thanksgiving off, and then starting earlier in the next week before we run all of the shows again, we'll remind ourselves where we were a week ago.
Right. So we remind our listeners, for anyone not yet having had the chance to see Lauren Gunderson's Silent Sky, that there are performances this weekend out at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And in which theater?
We're in the Black Box Theater this time.
Oh, okay. That's a great place to be. It's such a versatile space.
It truly is.
So remind our listeners who might not have heard our first conversation or maybe forgot some of it if they did listen, the heart and soul of this story of Silent Sky.
The heart and soul of Silent Sky. This is a story about three women who were three figures from history who changed the field of astronomy, and it focuses in particular on Henrietta Swan Leavitt, whose discovery of a pulsing that existed in a certain kind of star allowed scientists to locate where we are in the universe. And prior to this discovery that she made, we had no sense of how far away anything was in space. It was all sort of one distant mass. We had a sense of the Milky Way, but there wasn't even certainty whether something existed past the Milky Way or not. And before people think that this is just a play about science, I'd like to assure you that this is actually, it's a beautiful play about a woman who is so passionate about her work that she pushes against societal expectations of what women were expected to do, and really transforms the field that she was a part of. It's also a love story on a lot of different levels. You know, there is the love that she has for her peers. You know, they really support one another and help one another grow. She falls in love with the one man that is in the show, and who respects her mind as much as he respects anything else about her. You know, that it is a true relationship of equals. It doesn't work out. Spoiler alert. But there is such a great love between them, and it's a love, you know, it's about the love that she feels for her family too. She, her sister, the relationship she has with her sister is so important to her sense of who she is. And, you know, even though this play is set more than 100 years ago, I think so many of the things that the characters in this play struggle with are things that we struggle with today, and that the love that they have for each other are loves that we can recognize today. And I think that's a great thing, to be able to get a window into a different time through feelings that you can recognize from your own life.
Hmm. It's based on history, but it takes
some liberties.
Takes some liberties. And is this a show that unfolds, you know, in kind of standard fashion, or is this, or is there more to it than that?
You know, I like the term magical realism, because there are great sections, like large sections of the show, which function, you know, like straight realism, where you, aside from the fact that you're watching people on a stage, that more or less it's functioning as though, as things function in real life. And then we step into these more magical sections where it allows us to traverse large amounts of time. Some of these characters had to communicate by letters, but they are turned into a dialogue, and we have two separate planes of reality on the show. We have these, what I call the decks and the galaxy floor, and when we're on the decks, that's realism. And when people step onto the galaxy floor, usually only Henrietta steps onto the galaxy floor,
for the most part.
But when we're on the galaxy floor, that means we're someplace else. We're in some sort of, we're in her imagination, or we are in her mind, more or less. It's more timeless. And we are using projections with this play. And the projections and the light and the sound really go back and forth between creating a very realistic world and then a more timeless, we're out in the universe world.
Wow.
It's very exciting.
That really sounds cool. That really sounds cool. You have apparently come with a scene from this play that our two actors, Bailey Johnston and Josh Pride, are prepared to do for us. And I have a feeling this will help underscore the fact that this is not a play just about astronomy and a lot about technical jargon and so on. But this is a very, very human drama as well.
Very human, yes.
So tell us about the scene.
So this is the second scene of the play. In the opening scene of the play, Henrietta tells her sister that she has been offered a job at the Harvard Observatory. This is about 1900. The play is not super specific about times, but it's about 1900. And the second scene of the play is she's walked in, and it's her first day, and she is expecting to meet Dr. Pickering, who is the man who runs the whole observatory, and who is a figure from history. And instead she meets basically his attaché, Peter Shaw. And she and Peter is like, he is a man who likes to put things in boxes. We've talked a lot about this.
Very ordered, compartmentalized.
And so he has a new computer, as these women were called, since they did all the computations. He has a new computer. He's got to get her to her desk and get her working and get on with his day. And she has other plans. I like this scene so much because it's the start of, you see Henrietta's fire. You see that she's not going to take anybody looking down on her in any way. But it's also the start of Peter's, the change in how Peter thinks about women.
Hmm. Cool. All right. So this is an early scene from Lauren Gunderson's play, Silent Sky. And here are Bailey Johnston and Josh Pride.
Excuse me, is this the observatory office?
Oh, yes. Hello. You must be my 10 o'clock. Miss Leavitt? You are Miss Leavitt.
I am Henrietta Leavitt, and I'm thrilled to...
Great. We'll make this quick. It's not that complicated.
May I just say how pleased I am to meet you, Dr. Pickering? I am so honored.
No.
I'm not?
I'm not.
You're not Dr. Pickering.
I am.
You are Dr. Pickering.
So sorry. My name is Peter Shaw. I work for Pickering.
Oh, lovely, Mr. Shaw. Nice to meet you. Colleagues, then.
You actually work for me, and I work for him, so...
So we're still colleagues, it would seem?
Technically, yes, but...
And here I thought Harvard was such a technical place.
I just mean... I mean, it is. It's just... You see, I'm Dr. Pickering's apprentice. Junior fellow in astronomical research, summa cum laude. Mathematics and physics.
And if you spot me, I'll swoon.
What?
It's a technical term. Now, Mr. Shaw, I've come a long way, and I'm quite anxious to get started. May I?
Hmm?
Get started. Or just point me to the telescope, and I'll be fine.
The telescope?
Is that it? The Great Refractor?
Yes, but...
One of the largest in the world.
I am very aware, quite a point of pride, but this is, in fact, the workroom for you girls to work. In here.
A short orientation, then?
We bring the girls' department photographic plates from the telescope. Latest technology.
Yes, good. Question, why all women?
Oh, this is good. Dr. Pickering was fed up with the boys he was sent, and he said, actually said this, that his housekeeper could do better. So he hired her. And she did better. Now it's quite a women's world up here.
I was expecting the usual world.
Oh, I make regular rounds.
Rounds?
I come around.
To what end?
Evaluation, of course.
Mr. Shaw, I also graduated summa cum laude from Radcliffe, which is basically Harvard in skirts, and lucky for us, the universe doesn't much care what you wear, so my expertise and yours might just complement each other's if we can get past this encroachingly unpleasant first impression. Or I could take this out and you could keep orienting.
Well, you'll fit right in the harem.
The what?
Oh, no. It's just a name. You know, a joke. Pickering's harem. It's a compliment.
If you're a concubine...
He picks the best, is what we mean. We could just call you that. Pickering's best. Oh, Pickering's picks. That's got a ring to it. You don't.
I was supposed to meet Dr. Pickering at 10.
Yes, yes, and he sends his warmest welcome through me. He was detained. More important... Not important, pressing. More pressing matters. I'll show you around.
I'll come back.
There's no need for that.
I'd prefer to speak directly to the head of the department.
Miss Leavitt.
Mr. Shaw. I don't mean to be brief. Perhaps a little, if it would drive home the point that I'm finally here, after a long time not being anywhere. And I'd really like to get started, and all you've thus far conveyed is that I'm in some sort of math harem waiting to be picked, and that doesn't sound right at all.
I am so sorry. And Dr. Pickering is thrilled to have you here. And I would get in a lot of trouble with him if I ran you off on your first day, so please stay. We would very much like you to stay.
You don't sound very excited about all this work.
Well, it is work.
It's not your, how best to make you uncomfortable, passion?
That's a bit excessive for physics.
Is it? I find the very notion of this work to be a thrill, a bracing excitement, and it's just something you do?
Well, I enjoy the work. Of course I do. It's interesting and reasoned and sound, and my father paid a lot of money to... Why did you say passion?
Unlike for some people, following this curiosity was not easy. I had to insist, which requires a dedicated desire unmatched by reason, which is called passion. You should try it.
I sing. Gilbert and Sullivan. Wanted to be an actor? But Dad thought not. But I still sing. On occasion. With enthusiasm. Does that count?
Technically?
Well, here we are. One of the plates you'll be working with. A slice of heaven.
Beautiful. I should take one to my father.
Excuse me?
He's a pastor.
These never leave the premises.
You said heaven. I was choking.
Harvard property.
Of course.
Very expensive.
And if you don't mention the attempted larceny, I won't mention the musicals.
You're curious.
In every way.
Wow. That is a really enticing excerpt, I must say. That was from Silent Sky by Lauren Gunderson. And among other things, it underscores the fact that this is not an entirely serious play. I mean,
no,
it certainly
it's quite
has
funny at times.
Oh, absolutely. Say a word about what it has been like to portray these two characters. Josh, let's begin with you.
It's been an absolute pleasure. The cast is absolutely fantastic. Our director is wonderful. You know, we've only had 4.5 weeks at this point to work on the show, but it's been just an absolute pleasure. It's just good front to back. You know, we've done a lot of really good character work. We've done like a lot of running the scenes and stuff and finding like the intention, the motivation, why we are doing the things that we're doing. It's such a fun script too, because it's like there are more serious moments, but there is a lot of levity to find there, which is just an absolute joy.
Right. It seems, I mean, on the strength of just the scene you did, it seems like it's exceptionally well written, and I can see why it would be a pleasure to perform this. Bailey Johnston, what about you?
I mean, it just like Josh said, it's been amazing working on this. Everyone in the cast is just, you know, they give such energy and so much to play with and you know, so much to react and respond to. And it's also been really fun playing Henrietta, who's this, like, extremely fiery and passionate woman who, well, you know, makes some choices that weren't necessarily wrong, but definitely have consequences. And working through those consequences and figuring out how, you know, how to deal with them, it's just been very fun.
I can imagine. It sounds absolutely terrific. Again, the play is Silent Sky by Lauren Gunderson and Jennifer Sassaman. So there are performances this coming weekend. When is it being performed? Where is it being performed? And how do people arrange for tickets?
So the second weekend of our show, we actually have a bunch of performances. We have matinees both Thursday and Friday at 10 a.m., which are open to the public. But we wanted to make sure that if school groups were going to be able to see the show, that it was a time that fit within school windows. So we have 10 a.m. matinees Thursday, Friday, and then we have Friday and Saturday performances at 7 p.m., and then we close on Sunday, December 8th, with a 2 p.m. matinee.
Very good. And people go to uwp.edu to find ticket information, right?
We have the website. It's UW Parkside Tickets, all one word, .universitytickets, also one word, .com.
Very good. Jennifer Sassaman is the director of Silent Sky, and Bailey Johnston and Josh Pride, two members of the cast. Thank you so much for being here, and best wishes with weekend number 2 of Silent Sky.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. That familiar music, of course, is the main theme to the legendary science fiction series Star Trek. And I wanted to play it today because recently the world of science fiction lost a very important person. Her name was DC Fontana, Dorothy Catherine Fontana. And she is one of the people who really helped shape Star Trek, the original series. She passed away on the 2nd of December. And I want to replay an interview which I was privileged to record with her back in 2006. The occasion was the 50th anniversary of the airing of the first episode of Star Trek, the original series. And in this interview, she talks not only about her participation in Star Trek as one of its most important writers and story editors, but also her career as a writer in television at a time when not very many women were part of that world. Here's that interview, again, from 2006. I wonder if you could just say a word about the sort of circuitous route by which you ultimately got to begin writing for television. I think it is something that you had aspired to do for a long, long time, but this was at a point in time when probably most writers for television, and particularly some of the genres you were interested in, were not typically women. Tell our listeners about the way in which you were able to make this happen for yourself.
Well, I was a production secretary for Samuel A. Peoples at Review Studios, which was located, and they had actually bought the Universal Studios. We were doing a Western series called Overland Trail, which only lasted about 18, 20 episodes, something like that. And then Sam went directly into his Pat Garrett Billy the Kid series, a half-hour Western called The Tall Man. Sam knew that I had written short stories since the time I was 11 years old and wanted to get into the business of writing. I had been in, he said, if you tell me a good story, I'll buy it. So we watched The Tall Man develop, and I came to him with a story called The Bounty for Billy, and he bought it. It was early 1960, and I was 21 years old.
Amazing.
And after that, I wrote another story, and then I said, I want to do a script, and he said, go ahead. So I did two scripts for The Tall Man. After that, I sold a story to Frontier Circus, which was another show that Sam was producing. And I did a rewrite on a script called for a series called Shotgun Slade, which was a half-hour Western starring Scott Brady. So I was getting work because of my connections within the production, you know, of Review Studios and the series I was working for. And I always tell this story because it still brings a smile to my face. The guest star on the very first story I told to television was a gentleman named Leonard Nimoy.
Wow.
And, so I have known him, or had known him, since 1960.
Incredible.
I went down on the set, and we chatted a little bit. He was very nice to a newbie writer. and, of course, we kind of had a relationship later on, you know, on this series called Star Trek.
Yes, that a couple of people have heard of.
Yes.
I read something about your earliest days in Hollywood. You had been stationed, so to speak, in New York City for a while, but then made the move to Los Angeles. And I think one of the first jobs you got in Los Angeles was really as a typist more than anything. And the way I've heard the story told is that as you're typing these scripts for, I don't know, Leave It to Beaver or certain shows, you're thinking to yourself, I think I could do this, and I could maybe do this even better than some of these writers. Is that story true?
Well, not quite, almost, but not quite. Actually, I worked in New York for about 3 months after I graduated from college. I got an associate in arts degree in business from Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey, where I'm from. I saw this job posted in the New York Times, and I went and applied for it. It was at Columbia Pictures, but it was really Screen Gems. And the job was a junior secretary to the head of Screen Gems, Ralph Cohn. And I got the job, and I worked there actually from June through almost the end of July, about 2 months. And then my boss dropped dead.
Hmm.
So I figured maybe there's not too much of a, you know, market here for me. I'm going to think about something else. But during the time that I was in Mr. Cohn's office, of course, as the president of Screen Gems, he got copies of all the television scripts for the series they were doing. And as they came across my desk, that's when I started to think, you know, I think I could do this.
And of course,
so it really started in New York. And I worked temporary in New Jersey until September, saved my money for a trip out to Los Angeles. And I told my mother, I'm going out to Los Angeles for a 2-week vacation. I'm going to apply for jobs out there in television. If I don't get them, I'll be home. Otherwise, I get a job and I stay. So she was all right with that, and I got a job within a week after I arrived here at Review Studios.
Mm.
And yes, I was in the Steno pool where we were typing scripts, and I love to tell this story too. One of the scripts we were typing was Psycho.
Ooh.
And, you know, Robert Bloch's original story, he also did the script, as I recall. And I thought it was really cool. And I was asked to take the finished typed pages up to Mr. Hitchcock's office, which I did. And I walked in on a production meeting not knowing, and Mr. Hitchcock was very kind. He just directed me to the person who should be taking these pages. And later on, I became a very good friend of Robert Bloch's because he was a very good friend of Sam Peebles, my boss.
Hmm.
So connections.
It's meant everything, hasn't it?
Oh, yes.
Your involvement with Star Trek began as the secretary to Gene Roddenberry,
production
secretary. And it was only after the fact, somewhat, that you actually were able to secure your first writing assignment for the series, which is what we all remember you for. Can you just say a word, though, about the kind of work that you did for Gene Roddenberry before that first writing opportunity came your way?
Well, here's the thing. When I was at Metro, I had gone there with Samuel A. Peebles. He was doing a movie. And when he finished writing it, he decided to move on, and I decided to stay. This was in 1963. So it was roughly early summer. And I saw a job on the board. There's that, you know, board that's saying to put up job. And it was for the working as a secretary for the associate producer of a new series called The Lieutenant. I went in and applied, and I was soon working for Del Reisman, who was the associate producer. And Gene Roddenberry was the creator and executive producer of the show. So that's where I met Gene. And I was on the show through the filming of Lieutenant. And along about December, Gene's own secretary was stricken with a bad case of appendicitis and was in the hospital for a month and home recovering. So I worked for Gene because I knew the job, and someone else filled in for me with Del. And that's how I got to know Gene Roddenberry better. And he found out that I had already written six scripts or stories and scripts. And so I had some kind of track record, and he was okay with that. Then I went back to working for Del when Gene's secretary came back. But at the end of the show, in spring of 1964, we knew The Lieutenant was going to end, and Gene called me into his office and said, take a look at this. Tell me what you think. And he gave me about 10, 12 pages of something called Star Trek. And I was impressed with it. It was different. It was the USS Yorktown. It was going to Robert April. But there was this Martian named Spock. But I thought it was really interesting. And I said to Gene, when I handed the pages back and told him I really liked it, who plays Spock? Who do you have in mind for Spock? And he pushed a picture across the desk to me. It was Leonard Nimoy, who had done a role on The Lieutenant for us. So I was happy, and it never was anybody but Leonard Nimoy. I keep repeating this. There have been rumors and legends that other people applied or were tested or were considered. No, never, always Leonard Nimoy.
Was one of the best things, of course, that ever happened to anybody, that
right.
He and that role came together.
Yeah, but it took, you know, two pilots, and finally we got into production on the show. But as a production secretary, executive secretary, I had to type all of Gene's scripts. He usually typed them out rough himself, wrote hand notes, and then I had to put them into proper, you know, script format so that they could go out and be copied. I took care of any appointments, phone calls, you know, the usual office kind of stuff. But Gene was very actively involved on the first 13 episodes, and then Gene L. Kuhn came in as producer. John D.F. Black had left as a story editor. He went over to Universal. Was it Universal? He went to another studio to do a movie. And so he and his secretary, Mary, moved on. And Gene L. Kuhn came in. And we had another story editor for a while, about 13 weeks. And he was okay, but he wasn't quite what they wanted. And during that time, Gene Roddenberry said to me, I had written Charlie X, because I was one of the first writers. I had written Charlie X. In fact, Gene said, you know the show better than anybody. What story do you want to do? And I picked Charlie X, which is his story, my teleplay. Then I came up with a new story, totally mine, Tomorrow is Yesterday, which was where we go back in time and we pick up a fighter pilot whose son is going to be one of the first men on Mars, so we have to save this guy's life. And then we had lost our second story editor, and Gene said to me, here's the script. It's called This Side of Paradise, It was actually called The Way of the Spores at that time. It became The Side of Paradise. And he said, if you rewrite this to my satisfaction and NBC satisfaction, you're going to be the story editor. So I said, okay. So I did The Side of Paradise. And one of the first things wrong with it was the spores that are the contamination were in this little cave. So if you walked into the cave, you were contaminated, but the easy answer was don't go in the cave. So I had them all over the planet in the plants, which was, you could not escape that. So everybody would be affected. And then the second thing was, it was a love story for Sulu and Leila Kelomi. And I told Gene, this is a love story for Spock. And he said, go write it. So Paradise came out as a script and ultimately as a very much loved episode. And I got the job as story editor, which then meant with working with Roddenberry, Kuhn, you know, Robert Jessman, our production producer. I had to coordinate scripts. I had to rewrite scripts. I had to work with writers, hear pitches with the others, you know, with Roddenberry and Kuhn, and decide who goes and who doesn't as far as, you know, yes, we buy this one. Yes, we don't. So story editor is an involving job. But it requires a lot of working with writers. And we had a lot of freelance writers coming in. We didn't have a staff of 10 writers. We had people who came in, pitched ideas. Some of them were asked to come in because they were established science fiction writers. But we worked with a lot of writers. If you look at the credits on the series, you will see there were a good many writers, some of whom repeated, others just did one.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dorothy Fontana about her involvement in Star Trek, the original series, which debuted 50 years ago tonight, on the 8th of September. A couple things come to mind as you mentioned some of these great episodes, which were the means by which you first began writing for this wonderful series. Charlie X, according to Mark Cushman and his wonderful book, These Are the Voyages, in that first volume, says that the idea for Charlie X was Gene Roddenberry's, and he had by that point pretty much discarded it. And you were the one who saw this story and saw its potential. And that brings to mind the fact that one of the most important jobs for anybody working on a series, including especially the story editor, I suppose, is being able to see potential in stories and to figure out that this story is great for this series, this story maybe not so much. Can you just talk about the challenge of seeing potential in a story, even one that's maybe very rough around the edges, but could be potentially transformed into a great Star Trek episode?
Well, Charlie X is not entirely as you put it. Charlie X was in the Bible as one of the examples of the stories we wanted to do. So this was the material that was going out to every writer who came in, you know, wanting to be on Star Trek. When Gene asked me, what do you want to do, because you've known this, you've been with me from the beginning on this, I said, I want to do Charlie X. And so I took his story, expanded it, and then wrote the script. I thought it was brilliantly done on screen. But what attracted me about Charlie X was, here's this kid, abandoned on a planet by accident, being raised by aliens who know nothing about being human. So all he knew was how to protect himself, how to provide for himself, but he didn't know how to be human. And that's one of the themes I like to hit, especially in science fiction stories. How do you become a human? What kind of human being are you? And Charlie had to learn how to be a human being, and ultimately he failed.
Hmm. And according to Mark Cushman, part of what helped you resonate with this was that you had two teenage brothers. And so you could, in a sense, put yourself in the mind of a teenage boy and all that you go through when you're at that age trying to figure out who you are. And, of course, that was the conundrum of this young Charles Evans.
Mm-hmm. Yes, one of my brothers was in high school, and the other one was just in the higher grades in grade school. I didn't understand teenagers.
Well, Charlie X, of course, is one of the most effective and dramatic episodes of the series, and it was the second one to air. So a week after The Man Trap, the first episode that aired in that first season, Charlie X was proudly paraded before the public.
Yes.
You had a central role in the crafting of this wonderful episode you've already mentioned called Tomorrow is Yesterday. And one of the things I want to ask you about that is, that was one of the first episodes in that first season in which there is a little heavier dose of some comedy. It's not it isn't a comedy. It's actually a very serious, dramatic episode. But there is this light touch at many moments. And that evidently was maybe also something that that you saw as a potential avenue for this series that maybe hadn't been explored all that extensively before that. Do you remember thinking very consciously about that, or did those little subtle comic moments just sort of spring naturally out of the story?
Mostly they came naturally out of the story. I'm putting myself into the position of our pilot, looking around this spaceship. My God, it's a spaceship. and, you know, it's the future. But what is this machine over here? Oh, it produces food at my request. What's this thing? Transporter? What? You know, it does what? And we are in this day now. I understand there are companies fooling around with transporting small things now, not real human beings, but being able to transport an object from here to there with a transporter, which is kind of interesting. But I just really like the idea of, again, it's a stranger in a strange land kind of situation, and this very intelligent, you know, pilot who's going to be sent to the future is looking around the future, and what does he find? What does he see? How does he understand it? How does he take it? And that to me was fun to put myself in his position and say, what would I do? What would I be looking for? And it was fun to write. It was well done. And I bounced off the Naked Time, where we were thrown back in time. And, I bounced off John D.F. Black's idea of the time travel and how we get back and all of that, and then put it into Tomorrow Is Yesterday.
With brilliant effect, I must say.
Oh, thank you.
You've already mentioned the fact that when Star Trek needed a new story editor, you were handed this script, which needed polishing. And the result ultimately was another great success of the first season, This Side of Paradise. Which
it needed a major rewrite, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah. I want to ask you about the task of rewriting versus the challenge of creating your own story. And, of course, you did that, too. There are a number of Star Trek episodes in which it is your story right from the start, which, of course, probably got a little bit of rewriting from others. But there's something else about when you are handed something that already exists and you have to make it better. Can you just say a word about that process, and particularly as the challenges that were involved in doing that for a show like Star Trek? Typically, what kind of things were you often asked to do when it came to the rewriting process?
A lot of times it was the characters just weren't right. What would this character do in this situation? How would he or she respond? You know, also, a dialogue fairly often could be a problem. I mentioned the two problems on This Side of Paradise, which was the confining of the spores, which made it not such a great threat. So I came up with a way to fix that. And the fact that it was, as much as I adore George Takei and his character of Sulu, it wasn't the right story for him to have a love affair. It was a Spock story, because under the influence of the spores, we could find out who Spock really was behind that Vulcan exterior, that practically iron exterior of his, and was gone. And now we see who Spock is at heart. And I always want to know what a human being is, how they are, who they are. And this was a great opportunity to do that. And Jill Ireland, who's absolutely gorgeous as Layla Kalomi, wonderful. She bounced off Spock really well. I, at the time, story editor on the show, by then the time that we were shooting it, I went to dailies every day, and she was in dailies every day looking to make sure that her performance was up to snuff and that people liked it. And, you know, she's a lovely woman and extremely talented. But the love story had to be Spock. In my mind, it was the only answer it had to be to make it an important story. And Ralph Sinensky reminded me that in the original filming, in the original script, it is not indicated that Spock is swinging from a limb, you know, a tree limb or anything like that. We were playing the scene, and they happened to be out in the field, and there was this tree nearby, and Ralph looked at it, director, and Leonard looked at it, and they both looked at each other and said, let's play with the tree. So that's how the action in that particular sequence came about. I didn't write it that way, but it absolutely works. And again, we see something more of Spock's interior, that he has a playful side, that there is still a bit of a child inside him.
Right. You are responsible for one of the most significant episodes of the second season, Journey to Babel, in which we meet Spock's parents. And his father, who is Vulcan, his mother, who is human. And I believe Mark Cushman, as he is discussing that episode, I think quotes you as referring to yourself as the resident Vulcan expert on the series, or words to that effect. Not that nobody else had knowledge of what Vulcans were all about, but it, in many cases, people would turn to you, and you were responsible for maybe enriching the concept of who Vulcans were and then who Spock was as someone who was both Vulcan and human. That must have been especially intriguing, a wonderful challenge for any writer to be thinking about an entirely different species and in a sense to have a hand in crafting what that species would represent.
Well, nobody else had been Vulcan, of course, just our Mr. Spock. So we could do anything we wanted. But I was involved with the character. I really loved the character. And by being able to portray him with some of his human side showing in This Side of Paradise, that got me thinking about what else can we do. And we had briefly mentioned, I believe it's at the end of This Side of Paradise, that my father was a Vulcan ambassador, my mother was a school teacher.
Yes.
And that's all I say about them. And that got me thinking, gee, what a combination. Let's think about that for a second. How does that now affect Spock? How does the Vulcan side, you know, meet the human side? Who are those parents? And after the more I thought about it, the more the story started to grow, and I came up with Journey to Babel, where I introduced a whole lot of other aliens, too, but you're most interested in who the Vulcans were. And
yes.
How Sarek would react, and how does Amanda react? How do they relate to each other? How do they relate to Spock? And it was fun to do, but I think I was the person who was most engaged in who is Spock. At the end, I said this to other people, at the end of the first season, while we were still on stage filming, I went down to the set, and I got time with every one of the key actors. Walter Koenig as Chekhov wasn't involved yet, but I got all the others. Sat them down for at least 20 minutes or half an hour and said, you've been living in this sister's skin for a year now. What do you know about them? What have you learned? And they each told me something about how they had been thinking about the characters and what they were bringing to it, what they felt the background of the character was that we hadn't covered yet in any shape or form. We hadn't made any reference. We didn't know that Uhura, for instance, spoke Swahili as well as English as well as she does, etc. So I incorporated all these into notes for Gene Roddenberry and Gene Kuhn, and they went over them and they said, yeah, let's put this in the Bible. This is good information for new writers coming in, and even writers who have written on the show. This is new information for them to absorb and use.
Right.
So it was a good exercise. I did the same thing at the end of the second season. I don't know if it was ever used, but definitely the material that I gathered from our actors at the end of the first season about their characters went into the Bible for everyone's use and understanding. And while Leonard did not say anything about his, quote, parents, I had been thinking about it, and that's where it went into Journey to Babel.
Right. And, of course, that's one great example of how this show was so much more than just the monster of the week and aliens shooting laser guns. I mean, this was also such a powerful, personal kind of drama, unlike anything that had ever been seen on television before, particularly when it came to the genre of science fiction.
Well, here's the thing. Roddenberry first posited it as a sales point, as Wagon Train to the Stars. Wagon Train was a big series then. And as you know, it had Robert Horton and Ward Bond and other people who were the people connected with the Wagon Train. But you weren't so much connected, involved every week with the Wagon Train and where it was going so much as who was in it. And they had incredible guest stars. They had Bette Davis and you know, wonderful, wonderful guest stars. And they told that person's story every week. So it was, in a way, a continuing series, but with a long, strong anthological touch. It was a little bit more of an anthology, because it wasn't so much about the journey, it was about the people making the journey. And in a way, we brought that into Star Trek. it's not about the spaceship. It's not about the voyage so much as seeking out new worlds, new civilizations, et cetera. You know, bold to go where no man has gone before.
Right, and what those encounters are going to mean.
Right.
Absolutely.
And these are the stories we wanted to tell. Hiding stories about racism and sexism and political things going on in the Vietnam War, which nobody else could mention, but we did it in the guise of science fiction, and other stories that were important to our time in 1966 and into 1969, but doing them as science fiction. Hmm. And we got the message out. People understood, a lot of people understood what we were saying and doing.
Hmm.
And I think part of that made it so strongly attractive to audiences. Hey, they're telling stories nobody else is telling.
Absolutely, and telling them so well. A last quick question.
Sure.
Once Star Trek went off the air, it eventually returns in the form of an animated series.
Yes.
And you had a very strong role, I think, as story editor for that.
Story editor and associate producer, yes.
It must have been so strange, given the budget headaches that Star Trek itself was always facing, and increasingly so as it went on, to be in the realm of animation where suddenly you could place characters anywhere and aliens could be of any sort of outlandish appearance, and you didn't have to worry about, in a sense, the bottom line. There were also other limitations, but I wonder if you could just say a word about what it was like to craft Star Trek episodes in this new format of animation where there were new possibilities not possible before.
Well, obviously, we could tell stories about aliens that were different and more exotic or than we could live action. We didn't have to worry about where the zippers were and things like that. And, of course, great planets, great spaceships, all this other stuff. Our constraints, we did have budgetary constraints because there was a budget, and we did have to pay the actors. The only one we couldn't squeeze in was Walter Koenig as Chekhov, but we did give him an opportunity to write a script, which he did very well.
Oh, yes.
And that began him on his writing career as well as being an actor and later on a director.
Hmm.
The one constraint that was important to us is when we were doing the hour show, it was 65-page scripts for 54 minutes of storytelling time. And you could do A, B, and C stories. You know, we'd strong support lines and main action line, main storyline, et cetera. On a half an hour at that time, you had about 30 pages for 23 minutes of storytelling time. So we really had to cut stories down, keep them tight, keep them moving, keep them interesting, but do it in 23 minutes.
Hmm.
And in two acts, a teaser and two acts. So it was a little different from a teaser and four acts, you know, act breaks difference, length difference. Keeping it tight on the storylines, main action line, and maybe a small support B line. So it was a different kind of storytelling. I thought we did it well.
I think so too.
We were able to do stories that we never would have been able to do on the main one-hour show. And it did win a Humanitas Award in its second season of only six episodes.
Hmm. And at least one Emmy. And deservedly so. And, of course, Star Trek goes on to further life as Star Trek The Next Generation and films and so on.
Yes.
And, Dorothy Fontana, you are responsible for so much of what made Star Trek great.
Thank you.
On behalf of all of us who love this series, we thank you for all you've contributed to the series, and I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk with you in honor of this great anniversary. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Bye-bye.
And again, that interview with D.C. Fontana aired back in 2006, and the occasion was the 50th anniversary of the airing of the first episode of Star Trek. We replayed that interview because Dorothy Fontana passed away on the 2nd of December at the age of 70. Her career was a long and distinguished one. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, several different interviews, including one with the author of a brand new book about Disney around the world. In this brand new book, the author gathers together accounts of how Disney is experienced all over the globe through the course of one single day. Support for The Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. Our weather forecast calls for sunshine this morning, but then increasing clouds later on with a high today of 42 degrees. Overnight, cloudy skies and a low of 30. Tomorrow, sunny and a high of 35 degrees. And dry conditions expected for the most part over the weekend. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.